Welcome to Thoughts on Record, official podcast of the Ottawa Institute of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy. Each episode, we explore topics of interest to clinicians and mental health consumers from a cognitive behavioral perspective. I'm your host, Dr. Pete Kelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. Lydia Denworth is an award-winning science journalist and speaker. She is a contributing editor at Scientific American and the author of Friendship: The Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. Among other accolades, Adam Grant called Friendship one of the 20 best leadership books of 2020, and Booklist said it represented the best of science writing. Lydia has also written two other books of popular science, I Can Hear You Whisper and Toxic Truth, and her work has appeared in The Atlantic, New York Times, Salon, and many other publications. All right, Lydia Denworth, welcome so much to Thoughts on Record. How are you doing today?
I'm good. It's great to be here.
Excellent. Lydia, it really is such a treat to have you on the podcast today and talk about some of the themes explored in your latest book, Friendship. The, of course, the formation and maintenance of friendships, as well as the emotional trauma related to the rupture of friendships, are frequent sources of clinical discussion with our clients. I'm really looking forward to gaining a deeper understanding of the science of friendship so we can all better manage this really important resource. I know personally, I have really viewed my friendships differently after reading your book, particularly with a renewed sense of urgency around tending to those relationships, like even in the middle of COVID where there's so many obstacles, given the impact that friendships can have on health and well-being. So I guess just to start, whenever I dive into a topic with a guest, I always like to get all the terms out there so everyone can be on the same page. So to start, Lydia, for the purpose of this discussion, what is friendship?
Mm-hmm. It does depend on who you ask, but the definition of friendship that I like really originates with evolutionary biology. And a friendship in this context is a close social bond, and it has to have a minimum of three things. It's long-lasting, it's positive, and it's cooperative and reciprocal. So we can talk about what all those things mean. And if you ask any person out in the world to describe friendship, they might tell you other things, like they'll talk about trust and loyalty and all of that. But I think those are baked into some of the things I just said, like a positive relationship is one that's trustworthy and where there's loyalty, things like that.
Lydia, you devote a considerable amount of real estate in the book to exploring the relevant animal, neuroscience, and genetic literature that can inform our conceptualization of the human experience of friendship. Can you maybe describe a couple of the major findings that spoke to you around the nature of our evolved social brain and why we may be so predisposed to friendship?
Sure. I think that my book has two big headlines. I hope people will still go out and read it, even if I tell them. but the first is that there have been real evolutionary advantages to being good at making and maintaining friends. And so you could say that it's not so much a survival of the fittest as a survival of the friendliest that we've seen. That doesn't mean that that jerks don't sometimes get ahead, but if you had to lay odds on what behavior was going to help you out, then being good at building bonds was it. And the second headline is related, which is that friendship turns out to be as important for our health as diet and exercise, really, over the long haul. And, so things that are good for our health tend to be things that evolution, natural selection, chooses, that we select for over time. So the fact that it took a long time to understand that social relationships were as important for physical health as we now understand them to be. But those are the big ticket items.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that I believe I read this somewhere where when we meet a new person, the two things we evaluate are how attractive are they and how friendly do they appear? That seems to be very sort of elemental with respect to how we evaluate people.
Right. And if you think back evolutionary, to early humans and tribes meeting up with other tribes, that sort of connecting to strangers is, and it's why we shake hands and things like that. Of course, COVID has changed it all, but the origins of behaviors that we are about sort of figuring out who we can trust when we meet new people.
In addition to your book, I would direct the interested listener to the work of Robert Sapolsky. He has some really fascinating work on really long-standing, longitudinal work too on, I believe it was baboons.
Yes.
That he has studied, and then the endocrine or hormonal impacts of where you are in the hierarchy. And it's just fascinating to see how leadership plays out. And you're absolutely right what you said before, like a dictator among the baboon tribe will be not tolerated for all that long. And they may be able to wield power for a little bit, but ultimately they get ripped apart over time. We do seem to select for friendly, benevolent leaders ultimately.
We do. The thinking is that, way back, that being able to operate in a group and then to build friendships, alliances, it's not just alliances though. There's more to it than that, right? But it helps you when the predators come. So it keeps you safe from the lions, literally and figuratively today. And it also helped helped animals and early people find food and things like that. So it was very fundamental. This is why you don't find human beings very often existing entirely on their own. And it's because it was very hard to survive if you did that. But then being good at navigating larger groups is where the social brain became more complex and helped us to do that. The better you were at that, the better you were at understanding not just your relationship with that person over there, but their relationship with the other person in the group helped you navigate. And so, it's very fundamental.
I think Lisa Feldman Barrett, who you do mention in the book briefly, has a really interesting angle on this from a body budget perspective, right? She talks about how we have this body budget and we rely on people around us to help to regulate that budget, right? And it's true, some people are drawing down that budget, but other people are adding and adding resources back into our ability to buffer stressors, even if they're just emotional or cognitive, right? It doesn't have to be attacked by a predator. It could be someone going through a divorce or someone who's facing unemployment or loss of a loved one.
Well, I think of those as the lions today, right? The things that happen to us in the world, big and small. But it's, yes. So biologists and evolutionary scientists, they think in terms of energy and budgets, energy budgets. And, for a lot of us, that feels like an odd way to think about our friends. But if you think about the language we use, like a friendship is draining or a friendship is sustaining, it's speaking to exactly that concept.
Well, let's focus on the moment for the lack of friendship. You do talk about this quite a bit in the book. What is the impact of social impoverishment and loneliness on health? And what are some of the mechanisms by which we think this may happen?
You can think of loneliness and friendship as kind of two ends of a spectrum, right? Of a continuum that assesses your level of social integration. And the reason that there's so much focus on loneliness is, of course, because it's the thing that makes us sick. But it was also the way that it's sometimes easier to uncover a problem. And then the flip side was understanding, well, hey, if loneliness is bad for us, then friendship might be good for us, right? But so the things, to be clear, both for bad, if you're lonely, or for good, if you have really strong, good friendships, the things that are affected are everything: your cardiovascular system, your cognitive health, so your risk of dementia, your mental health, your risk of depression, your sleep quality, your stress responses, your immune system, your even the rate at which your cells age. So your biological aging speeds up if you're lonelier, and your longevity, how long you're likely to live. So, If you feel, that stuff doesn't matter, then okay, good on you. But this is why I say that that friendship is so critical for our health. And you asked about, how do we think that works? We know some of that. There's plenty that is still being uncovered. Scientists call the pathways and the mechanisms. Stress is clearly one. Your level of social connection affects how you respond to stress, but then stress changes the response inside your body in all kinds of ways. The example that I find most fascinating, though, is the immune system example. So what happens, we know now, in the immune system is that if you're very lonely on the one hand or very connected on the other, it changes the way the genes are expressed in your immune system. So your leukocytes, like, why would your leukocytes care about this, your white blood cells and things? Well, because they're primed to, well, so I should say that if you're lonely, you turn out to be more susceptible to inflammation, more susceptible to viruses, interestingly, in the time of COVID-19. And the flip side is, if you're more socially connected, you're more resilient to those things. And the thinking is that your immune system was designed for the, you know, early on, it was designed for certain kinds of trauma, like wounds, and you needed to be able to respond to that. But something that's sustained, like loneliness, your body reacts in a different way, and it's not necessarily the best response. So there's still a lot to understand about it. The other thing that's important to know is that it turns out that our body has that same response in the immune system to other things like extreme poverty, war, you know, really big ticket things. Loneliness turns out to be right up there, equally bad for us from a health and biology perspective. And that, I think, is really stunning.
No, absolutely. And as a clinician, we see this all the time. And we know that things like depression, which doesn't always go with loneliness, but often does travel together. Mm-hmm. You know, the comorbidity with respect to physical ailments is often through the roof, especially with respect to cardiovascular in particular, which may have that underlying inflammatory final common pathway in some cases. I think one of the interesting things about loneliness and depression is that they become self-fulfilling prophecies, unfortunately, right? So the more lonely that someone is, the more depressed someone is, often the more less interpersonally effective they become over time. It's like a snowball downhill, which is a real sort of tragic situation.
It is. What I think is interesting is that a little bit of loneliness can be good for us, because the way, in the same way that a little bit of stress can be good for us. So a little bit of loneliness is like a biological warning system. It tells you that you need to go out and connect. It's just, and it looks deep in the brain, it turns out to look a lot like hunger cravings, for instance, hunger pangs. So if you're hungry, your brain tells you you're hungry and you know you need to go out and eat. If you're lonely, your body is actually responding to that and telling you that you need to go out and connect. So if you pay attention and you do it, that's a good thing. If you can't or you don't, and then it becomes sustained, then that's when these negative repercussions kick in. And I'll leave it at that.
No, Lydia, those are great points. And that's something we've tried to be pretty consistent on in the podcast with respect to mental illness, that, you know, a lot of what we talk about as mental illness or that we pathologize is really just normal and expected reactions to life. And we don't want to go around pathologizing what are normal reactions. And many of the emotions that we experience on a day-to-day basis, even if difficult, really are adaptive and let us know that there's something in the environment we need to be attuned to and to activate some sort of coping. So I really appreciate you making that point. It's wonderful. I guess now I want to get into the weeds a little bit about some of the features of friendship which have always fascinated me. I guess as a first question, how stable are friendships across the lifespan? You know, there's that sort of, I think, conventional wisdom that if you end up with one or two good friends at the end of your life, you know, to count yourself lucky. So what is sort of the natural history of friendships across time?
Well, it is and it isn't known. And there's a lot of individual variation. But I think that the important thing to understand is that there's more churn than we maybe expect. And so there's a statistic in my book that I thought was really striking. So in the chapter about childhood and adolescence, I found out that in sixth grade, two-thirds of sixth graders change friends between September and June of the sixth grade school year. It's either two-thirds or three-quarters. I think it's two-thirds. And the thing is, when you're in sixth grade, 11, here in the U.S. anyway, right? I don't know, is grade six in Canada the same?
Yeah, yes. Like 11, 12. Yeah.
11, 12. When you're that age, and part of the reason for this is because in the U.S. anyway, a lot of, if you're in a public school system, you tend to be switching. It's environmental because you're switching from a smaller elementary school to a bigger context, a bigger middle school. So that's part of it. It's not just being 11. But when you are 11 and you're in that environment and your friends are changing, it can feel like the end of the world, or it can feel huge. And it turns out to be more common than not, right? That most other kids are also changing friends. And there's real reasons for it. And so I think you could take that analogy as you could say, that's a little bit what life looks like. Your whole trajectory, if you blow it up over your entire adult life, expect some churn. What really matters is that there are those good friends at the core. And, you know, so some of it is proximity. It's a lot of things, right? And we can get into what, you know, what brings us together with people and why we maybe fall out sometimes. But it matters less that you stay friends with the same people than that you have you have good friends in your life. The other thing I just want to bring up is that concept of a social convoy, which I think is an interesting one. It's decades old now, but it's a way of thinking about the people that travel through life with you. And so some of those people, like family members, are likely to be there for the whole time, but others are moving in and out a little bit. What matters is that there are people around you, but less that they are exactly the same people.
As you were talking, I was just struck by I'm sure everyone's had this experience where, you know, you had a really close friendship with someone, say in high school, you had a lot of really fun or intense experiences together, and you might in adulthood see them in the mall and you may even catch each other's glance, but you don't want to make that reconnection. You just kind of walk past each other. It's just sort of amazing how plastic we are. We can have and it's unimaginable at the time that you would never talk to this person again, but then, you know, life moves on. And in fact, you end up not talking to that person ever again. I find that really fascinating.
Yeah. And you know, there are some people that we seem to be able to pick up with wherever we leave off, and doesn't matter how much time passes, and others where that's really not the case. And I think both things are okay. You know, it's important that you behave as a good friend and that you are mindful of the things you like about how other people treat you. And so, you know, I could envision different scenarios in the mall there, you know, but it's work, right, to reconnect with someone and to do all the small talk that's often what's stopping us. And you know, there's so much to catch up on that it feels like you can't get to anything important. So you're just not going to do it, I think, is what, you know, is often happening there. And that's okay. But I do think that sometimes we hesitate to reconnect with people, and we're often glad that we do reconnect when we do it. So I might urge people actually just to maybe make themselves a little vulnerable or take that extra time. I think time and vulnerability are two parts of friendship that we don't acknowledge enough.
No, I couldn't agree more. And I really resonated with your first point that we may regard it as, you know, more work and already busy lives, right? It's like, you know, we might have the thought, oh man, I can barely see the people who I want to see at this particular moment, let alone adding another person to the mix. I also I'm going to ask you about digital friendships in a moment, but I've also wondered about Facebook as well, which I'm not on and have not, well, I was originally, but I have not been on in a long time. Mm-hmm. And one of the conclusions I felt like I came to is I have all these quote unquote friends on Facebook, but there's kind of good reasons why I don't see these people on an everyday basis that transcend geography or things like that. It's just our lives just kind of move in different, you know, in different currents. And so there's an artificiality to it. So I don't know. I'm not sure what the data says about this, but.
Well, the data, I actually think the data is really interesting on this because you're right. There's such a thing as a Facebook friend, and then there's your like close friends, and they're not always the same thing. What the data says is that we know the difference and we appreciate the difference. And there aren't people out there who think that all their Facebook friends are equally good friends or need them to be. That's the thing. We don't have the bandwidth. We don't have the brain capacity to be that close with that many people. The question becomes on something like Facebook is, you know, how much do you enjoy or find annoying the more casual connection that you have from those people on Facebook. So I'm someone who kind of likes being in touch with my old high school friends and a lot of college friends that I Some of them, honestly, I wouldn't recognize if I passed them in the street, and vice versa. They wouldn't know me. Well, maybe they'd know me because I, you know, my picture's in the world in a different way, but not, you know, we're not close. But what I, and I'll say that, you know, some of those people, I really enjoy their presence on Facebook. I think they're funny. They have interesting things to say. Others, not so much, maybe, you know, but the ones that I appreciate, I'm glad. And I mentioned in the book that, you know, my university is a place that's very big on reunions, and actually felt like when I went to reunion a couple of years ago, I was really able to skip over the small talk. There were certain people that I wouldn't know as much about if it weren't for Facebook, but I'm glad to know about what's going on in their lives. And we had more meaningful conversations when we met up. And then I haven't seen them again. Or, you know, one came to a book event that I had. The other thing I will say is that if you are an author, though, right, I had a rolling reunion during my book tour because all my high school friends came out and a lot of my college friends came out. And I guarantee you that that wouldn't have happened if they weren't all on social media connecting. And so we had like a really lovely sort of big dinner out with a bunch of people from my high school class. So there are advantages, but, you know, do you really need all of that? Does that sustain you? We were talking about what's draining and what's sustaining. Probably not. You know, it's not about that. And so I think you have to decide, people have to decide individually if they have space for that in their lives.
I guess two things came up for me there. I had Ethan Cross on the podcast last week, and we spoke about the idea of social media being neither good nor bad, simply being a different environment that we have to learn how to operate within optimally, right? And I really heard a lot of that in what you were saying, right? It's like, there's a lot of great that can come from it. And I think that's true. I guess the second point is sort of more of a thought experiment for you. If we were to take someone and put them in an apartment and they're, you know, not really allowed out per se, and they could only thrive on Zoom connections, email, text, things like that. Do you think that would be enough? Or do you think the in-person nature of a friendship has its own active ingredient that we really need to be attuned to?
I feel like this is a trick question in the time of a pandemic when that's all they had. That's all we've had. So I have to say it's enough. I have to say that it, because I don't want people to freak out. But no, it ultimately it's not enough. And we get something special from in-person relationships that we don't get from connecting via technology. The best relationships, and I think Ethan Cross is one of the people who's shown this, the best relationships are the ones that, or certainly he's talked about it, where you use multiple ways of connecting. So your friends in person, you talk on the phone, you maybe text, and you're on social media, because that's a really good way to keep up with what's going on in your friend's life these days. But any one of those things, like alone, social media doesn't really usually cut it, although there are exceptions, especially when people are like LGBTQ kids who need a community and don't have it. That can be critical. So it's really important to point out that there are ways social media works that other things can't do, right? They can connect you across time and space. And during the pandemic, that was one really interesting thing. You were just as able to have a conversation with your friend on the other side of the country as with your friend up the street, right? Because it was all virtual for a while there, unless you went out and met up for walks, which has been my major form of connecting with friends. It's been masked walks. And so that you need to be physically in the same place. But you know, it's in person gives you something special. We use all of our senses. Actually, the social brain is taking in information that's visual, that's auditory, but also smell and touch and things like that, which maybe people feel is a little creepy to think about. But actually, that's a big part of how we evolve to connect. And you can't, you know, you lose a lot of your senses when you're connecting online. It's also the case that different people have just, so some people like the Zoom calls, other people can't stand them. There was a lot of research showing that, that, you know, phone calls went through the roof in like old fashioned, kicking it old school, right? Picking up the phone and calling people went through the roof during the first in the spring anyway, of the pandemic. Apparently in the U.S., they rivaled Mother's Day. Mother's Day is traditionally the one day of the year when the phone calls are huge, right? Well, that we were looking like every day was Mother's Day in the early part of the pandemic. And a lot of people do say that those long phone conversations or short phone conversations felt more fulfilling than like a Zoom call. And I think the thing to do is to take the effort to figure out what works for you, what makes you feel best and most connected, and then to try to go for more of that. I mean, also just having like a joking text chain with some friends can be a very easy, quick way to connect, but can really make you feel seen, heard, acknowledged, you know, gives you a laugh. Laughing is really good for us, for our health, right? But we need those in-person connections. There's no question about it. And eye contact in person actually operates differently in your brain. It primes the communication parts of your brain. And when we look at somebody on screen, we don't respond in quite the same way.
Yeah, my lived experience really echoes what you're saying. I mean, I have a Signal group with a few fellas on it who are, you know, good lifelong friends of mine. And that's been sustaining me through the pandemic. But I really miss them, you know, in terms of getting together. We've been able to do the odd walk when the lockdown conditions have permitted. But it's not the same, you know, to be just sort of thriving off digital nutrition. It's not the same at all.
Right. But I'll say that it was a whole lot better than not having anything. And so if the pandemic had happened, you know, before this era, when we could connect so easily, imagine what that would have been like, how hard that would have been.
I don't want to imagine anything beyond what we're...
No, it's so true. Can I tell you that tonight I am actually having on my back deck four very good friends there are seven of us actually who have a standing sort of dinner that's a couple times a year. And then of course we haven't had one in a year and a half, but four of them were, everybody's vaccinated here in New York. And so we're all, we're meeting outside and getting together tonight. And it's our first, we've had like one or two walks with masks, but this is our first time getting together with a glass of wine and some food in a year and a half. So I'm pretty excited about that.
Oh, that's phenomenal. I've noticed any social contact that I have has been almost euphoria inducing in a way, right?
Absolutely. I was talking to someone who went on vacation and was at a beach bar where people were spread out and outside, but he was practically crying because it felt so normal. He's like, oh my God, it's coming back.
Yeah, it's true. It's going to be really interesting to see, you know, if we have sort of a roaring 20s kind of scenario that flows out of this. I know that's not my own thought. A lot of people have speculated about this, but
right. Some people say that. And yeah, other people say, no, I think it's interesting. So, you know, my book came out in January of 2020, right before the world went into lockdown. And I thought my job was going to be to convince everyone of how important their friendships were and how they had to prioritize them and that they had to stop taking them for granted. And then the world kind of helped me show that how important it was, because you don't know what you have till it's gone. And I couldn't have imagined a scenario in which all those relationships would get yanked away from us. But I hope that what people take from it is that we can come out of this and we don't forget, and that we continue to prioritize our closest friends first, but other relationships too. And a lot of that will depend on your individual proclivities, but you know, that we prioritize friendship, whether it's the roaring 20s approach that you want to do, or it's the getting a couple of people together, you know, in your living room or in your backyard. It's all good.
Lydia, what are the factors that predict robust, mutually rewarding friendships? Or I guess maybe in other words, what factors predict quote unquote chemistry within a friendship?
There absolutely is chemistry to friendship, just like there is to romance. And some of it is, you know, some of it is just like, it's simple. It's been the same things draw us to people since Aristotle has said, acknowledged it's similarity and proximity. It's shared interests, shared worldview. That's why one of the best ways to make new friends is to go out and do an activity that interests you, like hiking or drinking craft beers or whatever it is, and find other people who share your interest. I mean, that sounds so basic, but it works, you know, it's actually true. I mean, then there's work to do after that, but that's a good start. So, And shared worldview turns out to be especially important. But like a shared sense of humor, having some shared background usually allows a kind of shortcut. But on the other hand, people who come from different backgrounds can provide a real, you know, real diversity. And that can be really interesting and is also important. So there are a lot of different things, but some similarity, some point of connection is important, but that might not be as obvious as what you think it is. Like, you know, somebody can look very different from you, but you have the same sense of humor or the same politics or, you know, and then you connect over that. But then you have to put in the time and ultimately have to make yourself a little bit vulnerable.
Right. And I think that's a good bridge to my next question, which is, you know, you talk in the book about friendship styles, and there's three of them, I think, if I have them correct, acquisitive, independent, and discerning. And I thought that was a really, really interesting way of breaking it down. I was wondering if you could maybe just describe these a little bit. And, you know, I think people will be able to reflect on which category they may mostly slot into, knowing that they may use a few. Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So independent is the least common, and it's people who feel pretty self-sufficient and mostly have more casual relationships. Their friendships might be mainly circumstantial, you know, who's nearby at work, but they don't necessarily keep those relationships up. Discerning is the most common, and that's the instinct to want to have just a handful of very close friends. And a lot of us feel that. Then acquisitive, actually, so some later research, those three styles were established by a psychologist, I forget, in the 80s, maybe 70s, 80s, that's in the book. But and then more recently, a group of German researchers kind of revisited it and added sort of a little more rigor. And they decided that acquisitive breaks into two categories. So acquisitive people are people who are really more interested in a broader social network, right? They're looking, they're making friends kind of everywhere they go, adding to their network. But within that, there are unconditionally acquisitive people and selectively acquisitive people. And so as you might guess from the names, you know, unconditionally acquisitive people are sort of the kind of people, just inviting people all the time, interact, you know, just looking to be friends with a lot of the people they meet. Of course, not all those relationships are equal in their life, but you know, they're very broadly friendly. And then the selectively acquisitive people, and I feel like that's what I am, are people who do a little bit of a mix, as you said. Like you've got, you know, you're not going to just become great friends with everyone, or you're not trying to become friends with everyone you meet, but you're adding friends through your life. You have some deep friendships, but you have a pretty wide, you know, network and an interest in maintaining it. And I feel like, you know, I have a core group of close friends, but then I have a lot of people that I feel pretty close to who are a little bit in the next circle, the concentric circle going out and, you know, and on out. So so those are the styles. And yeah, they almost everybody slots into one of those. And it is a really interesting way to think about. And it tells you that there's no one way to do friendship. You know, this is important. You should do friendship to the extent in the way that feels comfortable to you and that you're drawn to. I mean, I caution that the independent style can be a little bit worrisome if you're really not making the effort to connect in any deep way with anyone. And I don't buy that the people who say they don't need it at all, I think that they don't know what they're missing, probably. But
no, I totally agree. I mean, I have many clients will say, like, I don't give a shit what other people think. And I just never believe it, because we're not, unless you're a different kind of human, we're basically wired that way. And thank God for that in many ways, right?
Well, right. It does literally keep us alive, as we discussed earlier, you know, in the big picture. And so it's, there's something really great that we get from other people, but it is work. People are work. They're a good use of your time, but they take time and, you know, relationships can be messy.
They sure can be. Vulnerability is a word that's come up a couple times in our conversation. And I think mm-hmm. clinically, this is one of the most difficult things to help clients achieve is to be vulnerable in their interpersonal relationships, especially friendships and romantic relationships. But what I've always tried to impress upon people is that, you know, the more vulnerable we are, it seems the more that others will like us. They feel safer. They can be more attuned to what we need or what's going on with this. What is the secret sauce in vulnerability that makes it so, you know, valuable in the context of friendship?
For me, when I talk about vulnerability in friendship, it doesn't have to be the really deep vulnerability. It doesn't mean that you're sharing your innermost feelings and secrets with everybody you meet, for instance. It means that you're opening yourself to the possibility of friendship early on if you're looking to make friends. But that means, for instance, let's say you're an adult and you've moved to a new city and you say, I can't meet anybody or nobody's got time to be friends. The question is, are you taking yourself out and putting yourself in places where you're likely to meet people and sort of making that little bit of an effort to introduce yourself to and it's not going to work every time. That's the problem. There's going to be some rejection in it, but there's interesting research I've seen that says that, we assume people aren't that interested in talking to us or that they're not going to like us as much as they often do, or they're more neutral than we assume a negative bias. Or that people are busy and they don't have time. And that can be very true, but it also can turn out that other people are also looking to meet new people or that, you know, but you'll never know unless you try. That's the first step of the vulnerability I'm talking about. But then it is also true that to become deeper friends, you do have to sort of open up a little bit. You have to trust each other. You have to, if you never share anything about your life, I mean, your friends ultimately, we'll find that a little odd, I think. I do when I had a friend who is a very close friend who got a divorce and then didn't tell me for a year and a half that she'd been seeing a couple of other, been on these dates, and it seemed like a very important part of her life. And I finally said, why didn't you tell me? You know, that seems, so what's going on there? Like it made me think that there was some, you know, larger reason. So, you know, we're not here to psychoanalyze that particular behavior, but it was odd, is my point to me. It didn't feel like a natural, not that you have to share everything with everyone, but some sharing is it, that self-disclosure, of course, as your psychologists call it, right? And it's what women tend to do a lot more naturally than men, but everybody who does it feels closer usually at the end if you share equally, right? If it's there's that reciprocity.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. And you mentioned men and women there. There is lots of conventional wisdom out there or narratives with respect to how male and female friendships play out. I think the stereotype is basically that male friendships are activity-based, women's friendships are more sort of tend and befriend or support-based. Is this actually true, or is this sort of, essentially just sort of conventional wisdom on the surface?
So the stereotypes about men and women and friendship are based in truth, right? Like a lot of stereotypes, there's something there. And I like, you know, the way it's often put is that women do friendship face to face and men do it side by side, right? So women talk, and men do things together. They play sports, they watch sports, they sit next to each other on bar stools, you know, things like that. And yes, there's some truth to that. Some of that is cultural though, right? But some of it is probably evolutionary. You mentioned tend and befriend. You know, that's the theory that fight or flight is what we always hear about. But the fighter, that wasn't a good strategy for women evolutionarily because they often had young, you know, babies to care for. And so what tended to work better was to tend to the babies and then befriend others so that you had a network of others to help protect you when danger arrived. And so it was the women or the females, if you're talking about baboons, you know, who were more likely to do that. So there's probably a little bit of an evolutionary reason why men and women behave differently. But what I think is really interesting is that it turns out that the similarities in how men and women view friendship outweigh the differences. And that's what I think we lose sight of. We get so into the differences that we sort of forget that actually men value friendship just as much as women. They tend to do it differently. there are some I mentioned, you know, culture plays into this, and generationally I see differences. I mean, there was a really funny, the comedian John Mulaney was doing a Saturday Night Live monologue, and he made jokes about how people his father's age don't have friends. They have their wives, husbands that they hang out with, like wives, friends, husbands that they hang out with, right? That would be like men around 70 or something. And whereas I have three boys who are high school, college age and beyond, they have so many friends, and they are, you know, they're really, really bonded with their friends. Do they interact the exact same way as young women do? Probably not, but they certainly feel that those friends are a critical part of their lives. And I expect them to feel that way going forward. And I think it's been more okay for young boys to feel connected to friends going forward. But there is a little bit of a joke that men, they get married and then they sort of put all their emotional eggs in that one basket, say, and then they sort of stop seeing their friends. And that's not smart. If they do that, that's not, that it's good. It's better in a marriage, actually, for each partner to have other social interaction and to have other, you know, and not be entirely dependent on just that one person.
A couple like thoughts that come up with that. I have a lot of military clients, you know, mainly men, but not always. And a lot of times when they retire, say like at between 55 and 65, it's a huge loss for them because their man network is essentially pre-installed at work, and they would just have to show up, and it was like sort of a de facto family. And then you pull them out of that and they struggle incredibly. Right. And I've also had family docs talk to me about when say a couple retires together, sometimes the woman will really struggle because her husband is basically around all the time.
Yeah, I have definitely seen that happen. And no, it's very true that we don't always realize our, you know, the camaraderie that we can get at work. Not everybody gets to experience that, but a lot of people do. And then when it's just gone and you're not in proximity anymore, you have to work harder to either maintain those relationships or to find some new ones. So in older people, it's the research is clear that the people who work to fill the void, let's call it, you know, either by working to stay friends with the people they knew or by looking to make new friends, you know, especially if you move. I mean, I always think this is interesting. You know, a lot of people decide where they want to move in retirement to some lovely community, but I feel like they very rarely base that on who they know there. They base it on the geography, but they might go to a place where they know no one. And that worries me. I'm not sure that we've thought that through properly and that we've seen how important it is to maintain some social bonds or to know that you are the kind of person who's going to put yourself out there in the new place and look to make those relationships.
Exactly. I'm going to pull from a little bit of a different topic, but I had John Berger on the podcast. He wrote Datanomics and Make Your Move, and he spoke about the suitor's advantage. You know, the idea is that when you're in mate selection, at the very least, if you are assertive and make the first move, you typically end up with the best pairing ultimately. So long story short, I'm just trying to make a case for people being assertive about their friendships. Like if you're just waiting for people to come to you, you may not be getting the fit that you're hoping for. You got to go out there, do the work, you know, build that network. It's not a passive process.
It's not, no. And I think that's what I meant by vulnerability too, is that you need to understand that it's an active, yes, it's an active pursuit that that making friends is that people are not going to come to you, and they may be assuming that you're not interested if you're not showing an interest, right? Or that you're, and maybe you're not. I mean, there are going to be people you meet who want to be friends with you that you're not that interested in. I think the statistic is something like half of our friends would not name us as friends in return. You know, there's that reciprocal thing of like, or it may be that they don't think of you, you know, where you fit in their hierarchy of friends is different than where they fit in yours.
Yeah, I think you had a finding in the book about social connectivity, and there was that one person where, I'm going to make this up, but I'll get it roughly right, where 16 people had flagged this person as a best friend, and yet she had named two or three, something like that, right?
Yeah, one or two, right. She was, that was in a village. That was one of the, I think it was the first social network paper. It was 1938. And they did it all by hand. They drew arrows and lines connecting these, you know, they analyzed everybody in every adult in this village, and who they asked them who they were friends with. And then they showed how these circles worked. And yes, the caller in the paper, the Lady Bountiful of the village, everybody claimed her as a friend. You know, she was the popular one. But she only claimed, I think, two very close friends. So, right, that's exactly how it works. There's some aspirational friendships out there, but that's not always a terrible thing though either. It's like if somebody, it's not good if there's no relationship there and you're imagining it, but I would argue, I don't know, I'm curious your take on this as a clinician, but that if you get something from that friendship, then that's fine. Like I remember being at a party for parents of one of my kids' grades when, I don't know, maybe he was in eighth grade or ninth grade or something like that. And the mother of a girl said, oh, you know, our kids are actually very good friends. She said, although my daughter tells me that, you know, that your son has all these other friends, but so for him, it's probably not the same relationship as for her. But she seemed to be fine with that. Like she sort of understood there was a different, I'm probably not making a whole lot of sense on that, but I thought it was interesting. It was like that was this very self-aware take on how friendship works in different circles. And we could all do with a little bit more self-awareness, probably.
Undoubtedly. as a clinician, I'll give you an A+ on that point. But it's absolutely true. I mean, this is one of the things that we're teaching clients all the time is to have the nuance, right? People want to be black and white about things, especially when they're anxious and or depressed. Right. Like people love me or hate me. It's like, meh. It's probably somewhere in between, and probably varies day over day and varies beyond that, right? So Lydia, I may have left one of the best questions for last, I think here, but, and I don't think this was addressed in the book, so I'm really curious to get your take on this, you know, appreciating that it might just be speculation around an age old question that no one knows the answer to. And many movies have been made about this. Do you think men and women truly can be friends, you know, devoid of any sort of unacknowledged actual sexual agenda by one or both parties?
Well, that of course is the whole question. Is it possible for there not to be a sexual agenda? And what I hear, because this has come up a lot in my conversations about friendship, I hear men say no, that there's always a sexual agenda. Women, that's not the case necessarily. And yet a lot of women are very, very good friends with gay men, for instance. And so when you have taken the sexual agenda entirely out, is that what it is required to do that? I personally don't think so. I don't think there's a reason why men and women can't be good friends. But it is true that that it's complicated. I wish I had a better answer. I think that we should, again, I think it's somewhat cultural, but some of the things we talked about, there's real variability too. So personality comes into it. And if you're so, you know, I mentioned similarity mattering and proximity mattering and things like that. If you're a guy who is interested in, I don't know, let's say you're a singer and there's women and men who are all involved in the singing together and they spend a lot of time together or theater, I would expect them to be good friends or possibly they have a good shot at it. Whereas if you're an athlete and you're always with only your same sex on your team and that's how you spend most of your time, that doesn't mean you don't have friends who are from the other sex, but you're just a little bit less likely. Maybe your primary interest is kind of pigeonholed you a bit and you're spending less time. I don't know if that's really the answer that you're looking for, because of course the whole question is does sex get in the way? And I want to say biologically, there's no reason why we can't be friends, but some people would say that the sex is the biology is the reason why we can't be friends. So It's a conundrum.
it sure is. There was an article that I read in Scientific American about this, and basically there's a couple of interesting findings. Number one is that men rank their female friends more attractive than the females rank their male friends.
Interesting.
So there's an asymmetry there, number one. And the other thing was that men thought that their female friends ranked them to be more attractive than did basically for the female friends, it didn't occur to them that their male friends were interested in them sexually.
Ah.
And the male friends were convinced that the women were interested in them sexually. And as the age difference was greater, this effect was more pronounced. So if you have I'll make this up, say at a workplace, there's a 50-year-old man and a 22-year-old woman, the man is going to dramatically overestimate how attractive he is to that 22-year-old woman.
Yeah, I was once that 22-year-old woman, and I can attest that that is true. Those 50-year-old men, I thought, what? What could you be thinking?
It's almost like evolution is making this last gasp attempt, right? To sort of like exercise any opportunities. I'm going to think everybody thinks I'm hot and attractive, and you never know what might happen. I think is sort of the, I don't know.
Well, that's definitely what I hear from, there are a bunch of men who say that, you know, the sex is always on the table. And so therefore, you know, the friendship, the real friendship is not possible. But I hear from other men who say that's not true at all, and that they have plenty of good female friends. And it helps if you are, if it's not about, gay and straight, and you've taken sex out of the equation that way, then, you know, if somebody is in a committed relationship and where you both are, I mean, I have, you know, we have a couple that my husband and I are very, very close friends with, and I feel very close to the woman and my husband's very close to the man, but we're also all very close to each other. And so it's, you know, and I would say that man is one of my very good friends. Would I be friends with him separately if we weren't all in it together? That I couldn't say necessarily. But anyway, it's possible. I think we should challenge ourselves to do it, to get out there and to assume that that this is possible, and that we have to, but that maybe we have to work a little bit about how we think about it. And
I agree. I also think in my experience as a clinician, people have to bring a lot of self-awareness to the table and be really sort of emotionally and intellectually honest with themselves about what they tell themselves they're pursuing versus what they're actually pursuing.
Yes, true. There's that self-awareness again.
I know.
It's very good. And I would just like to say on that note, I don't know if you were going to ask me this, but you know, the way I think that definition I gave of friendship at the beginning, which is that it's long-lasting, positive, and cooperative, can be translated into how we think about what it is to be a good friend. And this is where self-awareness comes into this, because I feel that sometimes people are very focused on how their friends are behaving, but they're not always thinking about their own behavior within the friendship. So it translates for me into being a steady, reliable presence in somebody's life, being positive, so making them feel good as opposed to bad, and being helpful, being, you know, cooperating and showing up. Those things translate to me, even, I just say translate twice. You get what I'm saying. It means show up in every sense of the word. It means listen. It means check on whether the relationship is feeling lopsided. Is your friend doing all the listening and you're doing all the talking? Or, you know, I'm not saying that it's tit for tat and it has to be exactly equal. And we all have moments in our lives when we need more from our friends and then times when we don't. So it needs to come out in the wash though, right? Over the long haul. So I think that self-awareness about how you can be a good friend, you know, when was the last time you told your friend what you liked about them? Or, you know, said that you appreciate them. We often don't bother to do that. And it makes people feel great.
Absolutely. And just as a tool to build that self-awareness, I'm going to be the annoying psychologist, the actor observer bias, right? So when something's going on for us, we tend to attribute it to our circumstances. When something's going on for somebody else, we tend to attribute it to their personality, their temperament. Right. So it's very easy for us to be sympathetic to our own cause and like yet blame someone else for being lazy or unconscientious or a bad person or selfish. And really, you know, we just need to be so attuned to the biases that we have in the way that we think through things.
Yes.
So Lydia, if people want to learn more about you or your work, where can they go?
The best place is my website, which is just lydiadenworth.com. It's like a lion's den and the worth of money, Denworth. And I'm on social media. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Instagram at Lydia Denworth and on Facebook at Science Writer Lydia. And you can find the book Friendship pretty much wherever books are sold.
Excellent. Well, the book is Friendship, the Evolution, Biology, and Extraordinary Power of Life's Fundamental Bond. I really, really enjoyed it. And as I said in the preamble, it really gave me a renewed sense of urgency around tending to those relationships. We literally just scratched the surface today with respect to the depth and breadth of material covered. So I really do urge people to pick it up. Really great read. Lydia, thanks so much for making the time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Pete. It's been great.
Excellent. Well, take good care and perhaps we'll talk soon.
Okay.
Well, I really hope that you enjoyed the podcast as much as I did. If you found value in the show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Or if you'd simply tell a friend about the show, that would help us out too. And now for the mandatory disclaimer. This podcast represents the opinions of Dr. Kelly and that of his guests. Content of the podcast should not be taken as psychological advice and is for general information only. Please consult your mental health professional for any specific questions around your psychological health. In no way does listening to our content establish a psychologist-client relationship. While we make every effort to ensure that the information we are sharing is accurate, we welcome any comments, suggestions, or corrections of errors. All people, places, and scenarios mentioned in the podcast have been changed to protect patient confidentiality. Finally, this podcast should not be used in any legal capacity whatsoever, including but not limited to establishing a standard of care in a legal sense or as a basis for expert witness testimony. No guarantee is given regarding the accuracy of any statements or opinions made on the podcast.